to the 29th episode of Frequency Resonance Radio. Today is Tuesday, the 6th of June, 2017, EV. Currently, it is 0140 Eastern Standard Time. So on with the show. Now, we'll be talking about discourse ethics, which is a meta-ethical theory developed by German philosophers Jürgen Habermas and Karl Otto Appen. Habermas' discourse ethics is an attempt to reformulate Kantian deontological ethics in the terms of the implications of communicative rationality. Discourse ethics, you see, is a cognitivist moral theory, meaning that it holds that justifying the validity of morals can be done in a manner analogous to the justification of facts. It is an attempt to explain the universality and obligations of morality by means of the universal obligations of what Habermas termed communicative rationality. The validity of ethical norms cannot be considered separate, Habermas argued, from the argumentative procedures used in everyday practice. There are dimensions of validity attached to speech acts and communication, and thus the forms of argumentation that they imply. So the validity of a norm cannot be justified in the mind of the isolated individual, but only intersubjectively in a dialectic. Thus, the presuppositions of argumentation become very important. We'll get to those presuppositions later. Whereas Kant extracted moral principles from the necessities forced on a rational subject, reflecting on the world, Habermas extracts moral principles from the necessities forced on individuals engaged in the discourse of justification of validity claims, and therefore from the inescapable presuppositions of communication and argumentation themselves. These presuppositions are the kinds of idealization that individuals must make before communication and argumentation can even begin. Habermas formulated discourse ethics as part of his larger project to reconstruct and sustain the Enlightenment project of emancipation and democracy. So a central issue for Habermas is the problem of relativism, which underlies several postmodern critiques of modernity and the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment project of justifying democracy and thus emancipation rests on these conceptions. Number one, that reason, at least in potential, is a universally shared faculty of humanity. And number two, that reason is characterized as a type of autonomy or freedom, which is capable of giving itself its very own law. And number three, that as reason is capable of finding universal laws in mathematics and physics and other sciences like that, it is capable of discerning universal laws in ethics and politics. For instance, if I exercise my freedom by choosing my own aims, my own goals that I want to follow, then that freedom requires that other people respect these choices of mine by not attempting to overrule them and take advantage of me. But if I require others to respect my freedom, then the ethic of reciprocity obliges me to respect others' freedom as well. Discourse ethics, you see, as a theory, is grounded in a fundamental assumption of discourse that an ought is intended to signify that specific moral norm is valid not solely for the individual who accepts it. That is, when I argue to persuade others to agree with that norm, I tacitly assume that this norm is valid for everyone in the world. So, the tacit assumption of the universal validity of one's claims is fundamental to what Habermas calls communicative action, which is the process of argumentation over claims. If one admits that argumentation can lead, and does lead, to universally valid claims, such as in law or in physics, one has to concede that communicative action is capable of arriving at universal moral norms by the same process. Conditions under which universally valid claims may emerge, there are two. Number one is the freedom of all members of a community in a discourse in which a community seeks to establish a norm. You see, in that discourse, acceptance of that proposed norm must be rationally motivated, and to be rationally motivated, that acceptance must be free and uncoerced. So it must be voluntary, 100% voluntary. There can be no force used or trickery. The equality of all participants in having a voice in the discourse regarding proposed norms and procedures is another one of these preconditions. In this way, consensus, that is, the voluntary agreement of everybody who is affected by a proposed norm or procedure, this consensus emerges as a requirement. Now, moving on from that, there are three principles of discourse ethics. Our first principle is that of universalization, which intends to set the conditions for impartial judgment. That is, to quote Habermas, all affected can accept the consequences and the side effects that a proposed moral norm's general observance can be anticipated to have for the satisfaction of everyone's interests, and these consequences are preferred to those of known alternative possibilities for regulation. Our second principle of discourse ethics is that, quote, only those moral norms can claim to be valid that meet, or could meet, with the approval of all affected in their capacity as participants in a practical discourse. And our third principle of discourse ethics is that consensus can be achieved only and only if all participants participate freely. So we cannot expect the consent of all participants to follow unless all affected can freely accept the consequences and the side effects that the general observance of a controversial norm can be expected to have for the satisfaction of the interests of each individual. So let me break this down. The first principle is that we can only have a norm if all affected by that norm can accept the consequences and their side effects of that norm's general observance. And our second principle is that the only norms that can claim to be valid are those that everybody affected can approve in their capacity as moral agents, as rational agents. And our third, let me break that down, is that the only way that a consensus on a norm can be achieved is if all participants are voluntarily participating and can freely accept the consequences. There are also rules of reason that must be observed in discourse ethics, and presuppositions of discourse that exist on their own. For one, number one, everyone capable of speech and action is entitled to participate in the discussion, in the discourse. So this means that anybody at all, anybody in the world who is capable of speech and action, anyone, no claim can be exempt in principle from being critically evaluated. That means once you introduce a claim, then you can't just declare it off limits for argumentation. That's a no-no. Everyone is equally entitled to introduce new topics, and everyone is also equally entitled to express attitudes, needs, or desires. So everybody is entitled to introduce new topics to the discourse of establishing norms. Everybody is entitled to express their thoughts and feelings on these topics. Everybody is entitled to express what they need, and everybody is entitled to express what they want. Participants in communication, that is, the people engaged in the discourse, have to be using the same language in the same way. And no relevant argument, no argument that is relevant to the discourse at hand, can be suppressed or excluded by the participants. So if a challenge is brought up, as I mentioned earlier, it's a no-no to say, nah, we're not discussing that. We're not going to confront that. No force other than that of the better argument is allowed to be exerted. So there can be no violence in the discourse, and there can be no dishonesty in the discourse. Only the relevant argument in argumentation is allowed. All participants should be motivated only by a concern for the better argument. Everybody should agree to the universal validity of the thematic claim. That is, if you're participating in the discourse, then you agree that the claim that forms the theme of that discourse is universally valid. You can, of course, challenge it, you can, of course, evaluate it, you can, of course, criticize it or argue against it, but you have to agree to the validity of that claim. And, of course, no participant may be prevented by internal or external coercion from exercising their rights. That is, these rights, as in no force, the right to express attitudes, needs, or desires, the ability to participate. So, we can draw a lot from this, as you can already see. I'm sure you can already see that we can draw a lot of ethical conclusions from this, just from these alone. And these rules must be complemented by a sense of solidarity between participants in argumentation, which involves concern for the welfare of both one's fellow human beings and of the community at large. Quote from Habermas, "Under the pragmatic presuppositions of an inclusive and non-coercive rational discourse, among free and equal participants, everyone is required to take the perspective of everyone else, and thus project herself into the understandings of self and world of all others. From this interlocking of perspectives, there emerges an ideally extended we perspective from which all contest in common whether they wish to make a controversial norm the basis of their shared practice, and this should include mutual criticism of the appropriateness of the languages in terms of which situations and needs are interpreted. In the course of successfully taken abstractions, the core of generalizable interests can then emerge step by step. Now, what this means, under the assumptions that are necessary for a rational discourse among free and equal participants that is inclusive and voluntary, no coercion, everybody ought to take the perspective of everybody else, and thus project themselves into understanding of themselves and the world of everybody else. And from this interlocking of perspectives, from this sort of putting yourself in everybody else's shoes, we can emerge, we can get a perspective of we, of the group, from which everybody can test in common whether or not they want to make a norm that is controversial the basis of their shared practice. This should include mutual criticism of how appropriate the language is that is being used. So in this course, the core of interests that can be generalized can emerge slowly, step by step. So the general conditions of discourse and the rules of reason, especially when combined with this sense of solidarity, lay the foundations for a democratic polity. At the same time, these conditions and rules legitimize pluralism, or a diversity of communities and participants who, while following the same set of rules regarding discourse, may establish their own sets of norms as right for each individual community. So, let's test discourse ethics, because of course we know that any ethical theory that really can legitimize rape, murder, theft, fraud, or lying must have some flaws in it somewhere. So let's check it out. Let's check out these presuppositions. So, let's see. Rape. No participant. Not that one. No force other than that of the better argument is exerted. So, of course, this means that, of course, rape is forceful. Any sort of assault is forceful. And thus, it is prohibited by discourse ethics. Now, murder is also forceful, and it also denies the ability of somebody to participate. And then we also have theft. Now, let's see. Let's see how we can answer the problem of theft with discourse ethics. So, everyone is equally entitled to introduce new topics or to express attitudes, needs, or desires. So, I'm getting from this that, first of all, somebody who would want to steal would need would it would be better for them to simply express their needs or desires. As well, no force than that of the better argument is exerted. Theft generally requires force against a person or their personal property. And let's see, there is, it could also be considered a form of coercion. So that's out. So how about fraud? That means, let's see. That would mean that no force other than that of the better argument is exerted. So fraud is a form of force that is, or rather coercion. No participant may be prevented by internal or external coercion from exercising their rights. So fraud is a form of coercion, and thus it is prohibited. And how about lying? So all participants are motivated only by a concern for the better argument, and no force other than that of the better argument is exerted, and lying is basically not argumentative and not conducive to argument, and as such, it is prohibited. I can go on. So here's the thing. Social welfare policies can be justified by the fact that everybody is entitled to participate in argumentation, universalized, and as such, not being able to participate, that would be essentially a form of coercion by denying the right to participate. If the social welfare adequate for participation is not provided. So that's a good argument for social welfare policies or basic income. That can be done either with a state or without a state. There are a lot of other situations in which this could be applied. I actually applied it to the issue of transgender pronouns, and the link for that is in the description. So that's all I really have to say. I went over discourse ethics for you, and now you know a bit about discourse ethics. So on that note, let me just say that our monthly meditation, as recommended by Rudolf Steiner, is Perseverance Becomes Faithfulness. So thank you for listening, everyone. Hopefully this was an amazing show. Don't forget to patronize me on Patreon, or donate with PayPal or DonorBox. Please tune in tomorrow for some suggestions of how things that normally are done by the state can be done without the state. Good night and love.